Good evening. It's a pleasure to welcome you here tonight. My name is Meg Stemler, and I produce programs for LIVE from the NYPL. The mission of LIVE, set forth by director Paul Holdengraber, is to create cognitive theater. We are honored to have acclaimed artist William Kentridge at the New York Public Library for a conversation on Gogol, Shostakovich, and William Kentridge's creative process. We would like to extend our gratitude to those who have made this program possible, especially Peter Gelb, General Manager of the Metropolitan Opera, Hilary Lay, Elena Park, and Caroline Cooper. I would also like to thank Marion Goodman and Linda Pellegrini from the Marion Goodman Gallery. William Kentridge's work combines drawing, animation, filmmaking, and collage. He created his first opera production in 1988, and his recent work includes Telegrams from the Nose and I Am Not Me, The Horse Is Not Mine, a piece inspired by Gogol. William Kentridge made his Metropolitan Opera debut directing the premiere of Shostakovich's The Nose, based on the short story by Gogol, which coincides with a major retrospective of Kentridge's work on view at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, Before we welcome William Kentridge and Paul Holdengraber, we'd like to share with you a brief clip of work by William Kentridge. Thank you.
William Kentridge, what did we just see?
We saw the start of a project which is called Drawing Lesson. That was called number 12. Numbers 1 to 11 are still non-extant. And it's, I don't know what it's going to be, but it's a kind of, it's a sketch of a possible way of working, which is both in the long term, trying to find the different parts of oneself. In the other, playing with repetition and multiplication, and in this case, playing with Marcel Duchamp's bicycle wheel, which is in fact a wheel used by spinners who spin the mohair for the tapestries that I made. They use those bicycle wheels for making the tapestries. But it's trying, really, I suppose, to find the grammar of performance for how to do a series of films in which I interact with the other people on the screen, the other selves. And so it's a test. That's kind of the first take to see how something could work.
Grammar of performance, what might you mean by that?
By the grammar of a performance, I mean the difference between having an idea and then seeing how to realize it. So for example, if you have a camera running backwards, you understand that if you run a camera backwards when you play it, or you film something and you run the camera, the projector backwards, you get a very different world. So if you walk backwards while you're being filmed and you reverse the projector, you in fact walk forwards. But now how to get it convincing that you're actually, it appears that you're walking forwards is not obvious, because it's not the same as simply filming yourself. For example, if you are, your normal way of walking would be this, and if you're walking backwards, you would walk. How would you walk if you're walking backwards? You'd lean slightly backwards. But to get it to be convincing, in fact, you have to walk backwards, leaning slightly forwards, so that when it's played, it looks like you're walking normally, as opposed to looking like you're walking that way. So that's what I mean about the grammar. It's things that aren't obvious in the idea, but that are necessary to change the idea into a kind of, into any kind of work of art, into any art. And that's a grammar not given by the idea, but given by the practical looking at what it is you're busy making. So it's finding out the rules of the form itself rather than knowing those rules or devising those rules in advance.
And those rules guide your work more than even maybe the text of a work.
Well, those are the rules that are vital to know for when an audience or people are watching or reading or looking at a drawing, for it to have a kind of coherence. So, for example, in the nose, in the production of the nose, which is on at the Met, for those of you who've seen it or will see it, there's a large papier-mâché nose. When the nose has its own independent existence, there's this large papier-mâché nose which has to be carried by someone. And the difference there is when you've got the nose, whether you are, because it fits over your whole body and you hold it, and if you're sort of moving in a normal way, what happens is that the whole nose is swinging uncontrollably from side to side, and in fact what you have to have is a separation of your body so that the top part keeps a kind of rigidity and maybe turns, and that the legs can have an activity underneath it, but the top part stays. So that's a kind of a grammar of that particular object.
So you wouldn't walk similarly, let's say, if you were walking with an ear than if you were walking with a nose.
No, I think that's right.
And it's quite important,
actually.
No, because
you see, with an ear, you've got an ear is a circular object. So there's a sense of a circular movement built into the way an ear might listen. But the nose is kind of, you're following it and it can shift, but it's quite an angular thing.
You're led by the nose in a different way.
You're led by the nose in a very different way. It's the same way when you're drawing a cat, for example. A cat, the principle of a cat is its spine. You have a sense that a cat is made by its spine. So a cat is always a line. So you draw any rough line and you smush around with charcoal around it and you've got a cat moving. Okay? Whereas a dog, you have a sense, a dog is always led by its nose. So you have a single point that's moving, the way a dog sniffs, which is different. So that's a kind of a grammar of animals, if you want to say, for drawing or for performing.
An amazing moment for you now. It's kind of a Kentridge moment in New York. We have, as you said, the Metropolitan Opera on now until the 25th of March. For those of you who have not gone, please go. It is sold out, but please still go. Line up and wait. I've gone to 3 performances, 2 dress rehearsals, and the opening night. It is tremendous. 140 minutes. It's 107 minutes.
No, it's 100. It's less than 2 hours.
Okay, 116 minutes. So it's a short, compact opera, which I highly recommend you go to, and I also recommend that you go to the Museum of Modern Art to see the extraordinary show on right now for the next 2 months. I think it might be right to say, and tell me if you find this correct or just simply provocative or just silly. That Gogol's nose was in fact in search of you. And that you happened upon it, and I'd love you to tell the story about how you happened upon the nose. But in effect, I think somehow the nose found you. You needed that nose very much. And in some way, like Borges says that every creator creates his precursors, that nose needed you, and you needed that nose in some way. And in your nights of insomnia, of tossing and turning, in some way that nose found you, and it's a hospitable and fertile ground for you. And I'd like to prove it before you respond.
Okay.
It found you on the fly. You sniffed it out. And in a piece that Kelvin Tompkins did for The New Yorker, this is what he writes in this profile that was published in January of this year. Kentridge was a bright, articulate child with a lively sense of humor. His father recalls an incident when he was 5 and his mother, who was taking him out, told him to wash his hands and put on his shoes, to which you responded, one or the other, not both. Now, your father, I should hasten to say, is in the audience, and I'd love to recognize him, Mr. Kentridge. I hope the story is accurate. Now, in the first page of the notes, which I won't read in its entirety, but which I'll give you a flavor to, this is what is written. On the 25th of March, an extraordinary strange incident occurred in Petersburg. The barber, Ivan Yakovlevich, who lives on Vosnevsky Prospect, his family name has been lost, and even on his signboard, which portrays a gentleman with a soaped cheek, along with the words, also bloodletting, nothing more appears. The barber, Ivan Yakovlevich, woke up quite early and sensed the smell of hot bread. Raising himself a little in bed, he saw his wife, quite a respectable lady, who very much liked her cup of coffee, was taking just baked loaves from the oven. Today, Pravskovsko Ospizovna, I will not have coffee, and Ivan Yakovlevich, but instead, I'd like to have some hot bread with onion. That is, Ivan Yakovlevich, who would have liked to have one and the other, but he knew it was utterly impossible to ask for two things at the same time. And his wife very much disliked such whims. Let the fool eat bread, so much the better for me, the wife thought to herself. There'll be an extra portion of coffee left. And she threw a loaf of bread on the table.
QED.
You see, in some way, you see what I mean. The nose was looking for you.
Okay.
Now that we've established that fact, how did you come upon the nose?
Well, about 5 years ago, I decided I would have a sabbatical in the sense of giving myself many hours every day to read a lot of books I'd meant to read but had never got round to. So I finally read Cervantes, Don Quixote, that year. And one of the things I did at an airport on a whim, getting on a flight, went to the bookshop, and as well as the usual thriller that I would buy, which I usually read, I bought a book of Gogol's short stories, as he was on the list of authors that I knew I ought to read, but hadn't got to. And a book of short stories was good, because I knew I could read a couple of them and then go to the thriller, which is what I knew I would really read on the plane. And one of the first stories I read was The Nose, which was, it's 10 pages long. I mean, Chekhov thought it's one of the great short stories ever written. And it was a bit like when I read Svevo, as reading it, within the first few pages, I suddenly thought, there's such a familiar sensibility. The illogic, the jumps, the rigorous way in which an illogical proposition is followed through with great conscientiousness. The extraordinary world that gets revealed, the mixture of self-reflection, self-irony, allowing the story, the premise of the story to set the rules for its own telling. Those were all some of the things, I'm sure, which has made this story and other writings of Gogol feel so close. I think it was a sense of what felt like, this is astonishing, this is written in 1837, and it feels as if it's from my life. It feels so completely familiar.
How so from your life?
I suppose a sense of being distant from oneself. The way Gogol is at the end, he writes this extraordinary story, and in the last paragraph he says, I don't know what to make of the story. Who's the idiot who wrote this? what purpose does this serve? It doesn't help anyone. It doesn't help the country. It doesn't help any national project. I mean, how could anyone think that that a nose could wander off the city in its own? How could anyone think that a newspaper would take advertisements about noses? And the strangest thing of all is, why should a writer even want to do that? So I suppose part of that is it had to do, he sets the problem, which he's just answered, of saying it's unnecessary but still of interest. So it's making a place for the unnecessary. And I suppose that for me was an important staking out of ground.
A place for the unnecessary, meaning that what matters most is not really the plot, but what is outside.
It's what's outside the plot. It is
what interrupts the plot, as we saw in that first page. He will have digressions and
It's partly about the digressions. It's partly saying this is a premise which could be anything. In this case, his nose disappears, but that's not the point. You don't have to start with the essay of the need for the project. You don't have to justify it in advance. The pleasure of reading the story and the possibility it engenders in us as readers is its justification. The possible worlds that it engenders. Okay, this is a world in which a nose goes on its own journey. Everything is possible. It's possible to imagine a world so different from that which we inhabit in our daily lives. And I think that's that and an awareness of the strange project that the author is undertaking. I think that, for me, the self-reflection, the self-distancing of the author. So he's both the author and he's not the author. He's denying authorship, or he's deriding the authorship. And I suppose the project that we saw, that fragment of the drawing lesson, comes in that same, the same terrain. And I suppose that just feels very familiar to me, being aware that we are made up of such different selves that, you know, contest for who we are and what we're going to do all the time. A serious self that wants to write the essay in advance and give a clear meaning, and the other self that is not interested in that at all, but is happy to follow a whim, an idea, a joke, a thought, an image, without in advance knowing what its meaning or value will be.
But does the nose, this protuberance we have, yes, in between
our cheeks,
our cheeks. I was trying to think what it was in the middle of, between our cheeks and between our eyes, has been interpreted by a lot of critics as meaning something.
I think they're easy meanings. This is a castration fear. He loses his nose, so he doesn't know how to be a suitor anymore. He loses his
power.
But that for me seems a very reductive, when you turn it into an allegory, it stops being very interesting very quickly.
So do you mean to say you read it literally?
I'm much more interested in literal reading, and also allowing what the author does, which is to give an autonomy to the nose. So when it sets off from the face, it's not only about a lack on the face's part, but the life of the nose itself as a kind of a free spirit, or in this case, a vainglorious spirit that wants to make its way in the world, that sees itself as a civic counselor, that wants an equestrian statue in its honor. And I do that without trying to, without trying to say, well, what does that mean about me, or who does that, or what part of me does that represent? The trust is that if one allows the nose its own liberty and follows possible trajectories, yes, in the end there will always be about the person writing the story or making the drawings, but that in that journey there'll be kind of discoveries or pleasures. So I don't know what it means for the nose to turn into Anna Pavlova. There's a sequence in the opera where Kovalyov, who's lost his nose in the production of the opera, where he's lost his nose and he's trying to reattach his nose to his face, and it keeps falling off.
It doesn't stick.
And while he's trying to do that, what we see behind him is the nose, now in the form of a beautiful ballet dancer, Anna Pavlova, kind of dancing away. Not exactly mocking him, but saying, you can try as long as you like to stick your nose on your face. It's never going to stick. So I'm sure if one wanted to, one could. If one needed to put it in a straitjacket, you could say, well, let's find the feminine principle in the nose and take a masculine object and make it feminine. What does that kind of mean? Is this about the feminine aspect of me that's being pushed in? I'm sure one could, if one wished to, put all of those things on top of it. For me, it had to do with a much more stupid pleasure in seeing that combination of the man struggling to put his nose on and the astonishing dancing of Anna Pavlova.
Stupid.
I think there's a big place, an important place for the stupid in art making. A very important place.
The stupidity of creation.
Not so much the stupidity of creation, but understanding a huge amount of the work, which in the end may have a meaning, or may sometimes with great artists have a profundity. But the activity of making it is best followed not by thinking the whole time, I'm writing something very serious, this has to be... It's not as if you have to be weeping as you write the sad patches of...
Really? So
it's a very different process. I mean, when you're
making a pleasure of ignorance,
it's
also a
pleasure of ignorance, because it's a pleasure of saying, how does that nose move? What do you have to do with the legs? How still do they have to be? What is the way you have to lean if you're running a camera backwards? You have no idea if you're in the studio watching things being made, the idiocy that you do, which is why a lot of the time I am in the studio alone with a camera. I don't want anyone else to see how ridiculous. I mean, to stand there with those three bicycle wheels and just turn them until the stick gets caught in them would be an embarrassment to have a crew watching.
It's an embarrassment we expose. Why don't we show the second clip, if we could?
So the second clip is also, and I'd say the second clip is very much a collaboration between myself and Philip Miller. I'm not sure if Philip is here tonight. He's not here tonight. Composer, Johannesburg composer. It's not a finished one makes of that. But.
Well, you enjoy the fact that you don't quite know what one makes of that.
No, I mean, it's a...
I mean...
You see, for me, what that suggests is it's starting to find the... it's also trying to find the grammar of what parts of that work. When do I believe that I'm making that noise, and when do I not? And there's different ways in seeing how things could... because even though that little brush and that two mirrors, that doesn't make that sound at all. It makes a very dull thud. And the one trumpet, that terrible noise, that I did actually play. But the other trumpet, the Schubert, the theme of Schubert, is not made by me. And so, okay, that's a mistake. We need to get that to sound more convincing. But then there's a whole other performance which starts with the interaction between the different musicians. So it's the first sketch of something that would be much more worked out. And hopefully during the process when it's being worked out, one will actually find what it's really going to mean.
And what are you trying to work out there? No idea.
No, I'm trying to work out the gram of what it is to be making those three or four people making that music together in that different way, out of objects in the studio. So I would imagine eventually it would be used in something that starts as a different lecture about drawing in the studio, in which this takes off. But until I do it, I don't know what the next part of the story will be. It could also end up as rubbish. I mean, a lot of things are worked on, and at a certain point you work out the grammar, but okay, you know how to do it, but it doesn't rescue it.
And some of the critics of the nose early on felt that what Gogol was writing was a lot of rubbish, kind of a bouillabaisse, a salad, and it didn't quite make sense. It was little bits and fragments that didn't coalesce.
Well, I mean, the great thing about Gogol, which Shostakovich has in the opera also, I mean, in the opera there are 80 different named characters. And so, some of them appear for
10 seconds.
10 seconds, you're lucky. There are two people who are called dandies, and they appear. They've got beautiful lilac jumpsuits in the production, and a whole costume was designed and masks for each of them. And their musical time consists of one says, "Hey, Michelle." The other says, "Let's go." It's less than 2 seconds. That's their music. Gone. And there are a number of characters that exist, and that's like Gogol, because what Gogol does so brilliantly, as Nabokov points out in his book, is that he invokes an enormous multitude of characters, not by having thousands of characters in the story, but allowing characters to emerge in a sort of sub-clause of a sentence. He said he was walking across the winter in that cold winter's day, like the cold winter in which you would see a peasant coming to market with her smart son who'd just been to the university, refusing to help her carry her sack of potatoes, and then he's on with the story. And in sort of, in one paragraph, there's a whole extra family that's
well, being... Well, you mentioned Nabokov, and one of my very favorite lines in Nabokov is where he's trying to describe the digressive style of Gogol, and he says, if two parallel lines do not meet... It is not because meet they cannot, but because they have other things to do.
I mean, I think it is. I mean, I think to extend that metaphor, to think of parallel lines as being, if you have to say, one of which is the world as we live it, and the other is the world as we describe it in art. And that veering of the lines either towards each other or away from each other is a kind of, for me, an interesting parallel to think of how we use art and how art, whether it's writing or films or opera, operates.
He, in one of his chapters, he ends by saying, his work, as all great literary achievements, is a phenomenon of language and not of ideas. Gogol, not Gogol. The final L is soft, dissolving L, which does not exist in English. One cannot hope to understand an author if one cannot even pronounce his name.
Well, as a monolinguist, as someone who speaks only one language, I have to disagree with that strongly. Otherwise, I'm kind of doomed. I think there's an enormous place for productive misunderstandings and productive mistranslations. And that there have been many cases around the world in which the best followers of one particular writer have been people who've only read them in translation. Have only known them not in the original language. And I'm certain, obviously, you lose things, people in the native, there's subtleties and there are different things which are lost. But there are other things not necessarily gained, but there are other imagined worlds which have been described, which other writers or readers take with them.
Say a little bit more about productive misunderstanding. I love the term and I think I might use it from now on.
Well, productive misunderstanding. I'll give you an example from yesterday. I was talking to an Italian journalist who was asking me about the exhibition, and I was talking about the first section of the exhibition, which has the films of Ubu and the Shadow Procession. And in contradistinction to the Soho films, which are more private, I was saying these are films of the public sphere as opposed to the private sphere. But she said, but what are they frightened of? And what she had heard was, these are films about the public's fear. So suddenly to understand the public's fear as the public's fear is a kind of a very provocative, and so I would call that one kind of productive misunderstanding. I'll give you another very different piece of productive misunderstanding. When my daughter Alice was about 3, I was telling her a story about a cat, and the cat was being chased by a dog, and the cat ran through the cat flap and was saved. And I heard her retelling the story, and she was saying how there was the cat was being chased by the dog, but it flapped its wings and escaped. And so it was what we do when we hear things which we half understand. We very automatically, we're constructing possible solutions, possible ways that they could be right. So there's a way of an energy of generation of thought and solution, which is one of the parts of productive misunderstanding. If you don't know a city, and you've only read about it, or you're reading a description like the description of St. Petersburg in The Nose, in Gogol's The Nose, you don't know the city. So you don't know the Nevsky Prospect, how it is, and the bridge over the River Neva, which in fact is a miserable little bridge that he's being described in the story. But you kind of imagine a possible city. It may be the wrong city. It obviously doesn't look the way the city absolutely is. So there's a loss, okay? You're not seeing the same things that the author saw. But it doesn't mean that you then stymied. You say, well, I've never been to Dublin. I can't read Ulysses. Stop. Until I've been to Ulysses and been through all the streets which are marked and gone with the concordance and a guide and told me what to do, then I'm ready to read the book. You know, you can read it in two ways. You can read it where you completely construct a possible Dublin for yourself, and that's one reading and understanding of each chapter. And another, if you are familiar with parts of Dublin, I'm sure that you inhabit those in a different way. But I'm a strong believer in our way of being able to imagine context, even if it's a wrong imagination, even if it's not the one the original author had.
Very liberating that way.
I think it is. I mean, I think, for example, in different ways, talk about mistranslation, you have the great Rilke poem, The Panther. And I don't speak German, but there's a key line in the second stanza where he's talking about the panther walking backwards and forwards in front of its bars until the world is, all it sees is the bars and the world ceases to exist. And it talks about the pacing. And there are many different translations of the action. And one of them is, it's like a dance of strength around a center in which a mighty will was put to sleep. And I'm sure it's not a particularly accurate translation. And I've read many others which for me are completely unevocative. But that particular translation seems to me such a description of what one's life can be. Where you don't know what's at the center, but there's an extraordinary movement and powerful movement around it, circling it. And you don't necessarily have to know the center for that walk to stop, to cease existing. So there's a whole kind of world generated by that particular translator's phrase, and it's generated further by Will and my name being Will. So, okay, so then I think, okay, is this me in the center and lots of activities all around? I'll make an opera, an exhibition, all of these things, because I don't really know it's in the center, so I have to know I exist by external objects that are made around it. So that's another way in which one would say, maybe in some senses I'm missing a lot of the subtlety of the language that Rilke uses, but in other ways it becomes an enormously powerful poem for me in its own right, in its own bastardized, mistranslated or inaccurate way. And I'm
Which
a
is
big supporter of that kind, or not supporter, believer in that kind of impurity. I think the dangers of all kinds of purity and authority are enormous.
And also when we are talking to each other, we are constantly translating, or I'm trying to understand what you're saying, and I'm understanding that you have an obsession with decentering yourself in some way.
And it is. I mean, so even as you're reading the section about the two parallel lines, okay, how the hell does one follow that up? What can those mean, two parallel lines going together? And I think, okay, well, if one is art and the other is life, then one of the things art can do is it can go back on itself. You can't stop the passage of time as you live your life, but you can stop reading, go back to the same book, pick it up again, go and visit the same picture again. The artist can shift their lines sometimes onto reality. You work with a found object, and for a while you're kind of tracking on top of the other line, and then shift it back. So I think that sense of that double life, of a world that we imagine, that we construct, and the world that we actually go through all the time are very clear, or very, yeah, it's a clear metaphor for them.
What was it like growing up in South Africa in a family of lawyers? And do you feel that in some way, by other means, you are pursuing some of the legacy?
I don't say, am I under oath?
Yes, absolutely. And in front of your father. Speak clearly.
No, well, as I will say, and as I have said to my dad, one of the things growing up in a family of lawyers in which there was a very sharp and very clear interrogation of argument. An argument was made, it would be seen whether it held water or not. One of the things that became essential for me was being able to arrive at an opinion that was not subject to cross-examination. That was kind of impervious to it. And I suppose that's one of the reasons why I became an artist, and one has to think that it was essentially saying there must be a way of having knowledge in the world that isn't based in rationality. You take a piece of music, you can analyze it, but you can't really give a rational reason for its existence or justification. And the same with the drawing or painting. So I think that was it was a very good thing to know what, you know, there was a side of me, and it's still a side of me, which is very interested and connected to rigorous, rational debate. One of those three idiots on the screen, he will hold on to that strongly. And there's another one who is happy to turn the wheel and see what happens. And if you put your finger in the spokes, see what happens when you put your finger in the spokes. So that's a very different...
But sometimes you put your fingers in the spokes, as your father, I believe, did, as a lawyer fighting injustice in South Africa. And I'm wondering to what extent you consider your work an extension of his by the means of art.
I don't. I think they're very, it would be foolish to think that what I'm doing with painting is the same thing that my dad was doing.
But are you doing political art?
I'm not doing political art. By political art, I mean art with a very clear argument and agenda and meaning known in advance, which the art is going to illustrate. I'm interested in the polemic that says the political itself is much less clear than that and much more ambiguous and much more surprising. So I'm certainly interested in working with the world as it appears, which includes the social, the private, the political, the culturally formed, understanding that's how we are made up. But allowing within that a kind of ambiguity, contradiction, uncertain endings, in the belief that those are not inaccurate descriptions of the political world also.
Ambiguity and also leaving things open, so you leave room open for possibilities.
Leaving things open for possibilities and understanding in all parts of the world, and certainly in the political, the contradictions and transformations that are built into it.
To some extent, one could say that you've remained rather provincial. You've always stayed in the same place. Not only have you stayed in the same place, but now, if I'm correct in assuming this, you live in the very house in which you grew up.
I mean, there's one... I suppose that's right. There's a sense of being a medieval peasant in the sense that all the houses I've lived in and the schools and university... All of those are within like a 3-kilometer radius.
Why this fear of going elsewhere?
But I suppose it's not so much...
The sphere of staying at home.
The Johannesburg sphere, that small sphere of Johannesburg suburban life. I think there are different reasons. Partly it has to do with not so much inertia as ties that keep me there. So family, friends, collaborators with the work that I do, editors, composers. It's a very... rich way of working and strong connection to my wife, who's a medical practitioner there, and her patients and her practice is there. So they're very strong external reasons also to stay there. But internally, I suppose one of the fears was I don't know quite who I would become if I was working. I mean, I'm sure I'd become
a... I don't view you as somebody who's particularly surprised in being many different people you don't know.
I suppose it's difficult to know. I'm trying to think, why would I be... I mean, I'm in New York. I think this is a fabulous city. I could absolutely imagine living here and working here. Yeah. But so I don't feel
form,
I have to come. But
a
it's
form
not
of
saying,
longing.
It's, no, it's not a form of longing. It's not saying I could do that and that would not be terrible. I'd be very happy. But it's not as if I think, oh, I'm going back to Johannesburg. That's terrible. I think I'm going back to Johannesburg. It's lively. There are extraordinary, interesting things going on. There are interesting thoughts. It's a very interesting city with a very interesting history and strange, awful, and good atmosphere, both. And also the fact that it is now possible, which might well have not been possible 30 years ago, to say I'm going to live in Johannesburg, but my work will be seen both in Johannesburg, with galleries and museums and institutions there, and here and in many other parts of the world. That would have been difficult, you know, 30 years ago when there weren't galleries and institutions prepared to take. I came to New York in 1986 with a portfolio under my arm, knocking on gallery doors trying to show my wares to see if they would take me. And I thought the biggest problem would be that I was a white South African. And the second problem would be, in fact, I discovered the third greatest difficulty for galleries then in 1986 was that I was a white South African. The second most difficult was that I didn't do oil painting, that I did work on paper. That they thought we had. But the hardest thing for them was that I didn't live in New York. If you want to be here, the term, the disgusting, the revolting term always used was, come and pay your dues, as if this was some medieval court at which the peasants had to come and give the tithe and then the Duke of the Manor would allow you to sleep on the floor, paying your dues. So it was kind of astonishing for me when years later Marion Goodman of Marion Goodman Gallery saw the work and welcomed me into New York in a very different, as she has so many other artists, and the whole atmosphere both there and in the institutions has changed
but
enormously.
But this was hardly planned for you to become an artist.
No, it was not. I mean, did I plan to be an artist?
No. It would seem you tried your hands
at
so many different things.
I was reduced to being an artist.
I feel for you, but reduced from what? I mean, what it would seem that you tried many different things.
I tried many different things. When I was a student, I thought I would make money by making enamel jewelry. And I spent hours with a kiln in the house we lived in trying to make enamel earrings and everything, and I failed miserably at that. No one ever bought them. They were very ugly. They were bad jeweled. They were a disaster. Then at one stage I thought I would be an actor and went to theatre school to see if I could be an actor, but failed at that also. The range of what I could do as an actor was so limited that it was clear I would never have a life as an actor. I tried being a painter and oil paint on canvas, but was unable to manage that. Worked in the film industry, but could never get the scripts I'd written made. And so found, kind of not through a desire, but through that's all that was kind of left myself back in the studio making drawings. And that's kind of what I've stayed doing. And so it was a long period. In the end, it took me till I was about 30 before I acknowledged I could. But I think I was 30 before I could write on any official document, occupation artist. Before that, I just always used to put a vague technician.
This lack of focus that you suffered from in your early years, you have found it to be a virtue now.
Well, that took a while because the conventional wisdom that I subscribe to entirely myself, let it be said, was that if you're going to succeed in something, you have to specialize and focus on it.
You have to be dogged.
If you're going to make drawings, just make drawings. There isn't time enough to do anything else. If you're going to do theater, just do theater. But if you try to do both, you're doomed to failure. You will be a dilettante, you will be an amateur. And it took me a long time to understand that I am a dilettante, I am an amateur, but that's what I need to be. And the only hope for either the drawings or the theater is that the other sphere exists.
And these words are stupendous, because both of them, amateur is quite obvious, simply means someone who loves, but dilettante until the Industrial Revolution meant someone who delights in, delectare.
No, I mean, I am using it in that sense. That wasn't the sense that people used it in warning, but it was the sense in which I embraced it. And at a certain point, I understood it was stupid to try to think what I should do. It was what I was doing. And however much I said, I'm not going to make drawings again, I found I was making drawings. When I thought, well, I can't do theater and drawings, I found I was directing Handspring Puppet Company with something that was both drawing and theater and animation. And about that stage, I gave up. I said, well, it doesn't work. I'm ineducable. I will not listen to advice.
So the moment you're experiencing now in New York, with all these different forms coming together, plus in the opera, all these different forms finding themselves in an opera, is a vindication of non-specialization.
Well, it's a vindication for some. I think there are some people in the art world who say, love your theater work, and some people in the theater world say, love your artwork, but don't come in our terrain. But it is. I mean, it's a complete treat to have the exhibition at the same time as the opera for how it enlarges the opera, and to have the opera at the same time as the exhibition for how it completes it. And I've always been very reluctant to ascribe a hierarchy of, are the drawings about the films, or are the films made to make the drawings? They both exist to provoke each other.
The nose is very much about hierarchy.
In the nose, the story of the nose is about the terrors of hierarchy, about the hierarchy of Russian bureaucracy, about the hierarchy of Russian society. And it's in one sense, you could look at it as a tiny subset of the various different great chains of being, medieval chains of being that would have been done with the Tsar, God at the top, and then angels, and then the patriarchs, and then the Tsar, and then the nobles, and then the clergy, and then the farmers, and then the gypsies, then the thieves and pirates, then the Muslims and the Jews, and then there are plants, animals, and stones. So it's in that hierarchy that the different bureaucratic ranks were also made. And the great thing about the story is that when the nose leaves the face, the nose is like three ranks higher in the bureaucracy than the person who's lost the nose. So the nose won't talk to his face.
Was this significant for you in some political context, once again, thinking about it as, in this particular case, an allegory of what you had lived through in South Africa?
It's not so much a direct allegory, but what living in South Africa during the apartheid years, which was all my growing up till I was 40, was it made one understand the absurd as an accurate description of a society. So in South Africa, the hierarchies were, they weren't bureaucratic or about God and the angels, but you would have had a hierarchy of whites, and then below whites were people who were designated as, I think Japanese were honorary whites, so they were second below whites. Then you had Chinese below Japanese, then you had a category called other Asian, and below that you had a category called Indian, then you had a category called colored, and then you had a category called black. And there was this stratification, these 50, so it was a kind of a crazy system, but then carried through with extreme rigor of logic. It's as crazy as anything that happens in the nose. So that made me understand that contradiction and absurdity is not a mistake at the edges of a society, but you can construct an entire society based on that. So I think that's really the connection. That's why the absurd seems a familiar and a natural form rather than just a joke.
And humor also is so prevalent in the nose. It's also quite funny, except for the person who lost his nose.
Well, humor as opposed to tragedy is always better for describing grand either systems or events that involve more than one person. Because the tragic is always tragic to an individual, whereas the humor is much broader, much wider, much wider. The person who loses his nose, for him it's a tragedy. But for everybody else watching from the sidelines, including us, we have a very distant, less compassionate view. It's about also an illogic in society rather than a weakness of an individual. So I think in many ways humor is an important way of dealing with enormous with human disasters.
When I mentioned the word insomnia, what does it conjure?
I suppose it conjures two things. It conjures three things. Boredom, lying awake for hours, waiting to go back to sleep. Wishing that your brain would have an interesting thought. Lying next to yourself saying, well, say something. Say something interesting. And the other says, no, I'm just going to lie at the ceiling and say nothing. It conjures sometimes panic. Trying to work out lying. Because the sense is when you wake at 4 a.m, very often, the owl of anxiety, rather the owl of Minerva, comes and lands on anything near the bed. It will land, and there's always an anxiety for it to perch on. And sometimes it's also very productive, a time of ideas, sparking other ideas, of rewriting a project, remaking a project, different thoughts. So it's there. It's not a huge, compared to a serious insomniac, I would say I have insomnia light.
I suffer from insomnia quite a lot, and I always say that I keep the night company.
Okay. I sort of am very aware of the night waiting outside the door, but try not to invite it in. Won't talk to it.
Because insomnia is really making the night present.
No, for me it seems time out of the night. It's a kind of a different. No, I have an antagonism to the night that appears then. I don't feel, oh, we're just lying quietly, the darkness and I, and time passing, and eventually we'll hear the birds and there'll be some blue in the sky.
So you get up and you pace?
No, I don't pace in the middle of the night. I think Anne would go crazy if I was walking round and round the room. I sometimes read.
But you spend a fair amount of time pacing. I've seen you, and don't say the contrary, but I have seen you pace a lot.
I think pacing, there are different kinds of pacing, and the walking and thinking, we could do a whole separate talk just about walking.
Let's start there.
Okay, yeah. With walking and thinking. I mean, there's different kinds of walking, so you have, I think my pace of walking is extremely slow, and that's because in Johannesburg, essentially, I get around by a motor car. So when I come to New York, I'm always shocked when my friends walk at such an astonishing pace because they're actually going somewhere. And so I'm very in favor of the two things, the old passeggiata that would have been in 19th century European cities for kind of digestion after a meal and conversation.
And going back and forth.
Yes. And the big promenades you had also in big estates for walking and thinking. The idea that slow walking was a way of aiding thinking. And what we have now, which drives me crazy, is walking as exercise.
Working out?
Yes, but the idea, firstly, that when you go walking, you very often go walking now hiking. And what that generally means is two things. A, it's done in single file. And B, it's done at a pace or a vigor that you can't actually talk. You're busy trying to catch your breath. And then the very worst form of that is walking on a treadmill in a gym, in which you are neither talking nor are you strolling, and you're not even thinking because you often have a television set in front of you which thinks for you. So,
and you're not even going anywhere.
Well, they're not going anywhere. I don't go anywhere in the studio. I go round and round. But there is something about stalking an image, about simply pacing around and around the studio until either a moment of decision or a moment of certainty for the first mark, but then the page or the sheet of paper finally gets approached and done. And then if something goes really well, I step back from it and again there's more pacing. And that's why the animated films work very well, because they build into the very making of the film a process of walking between the camera and the drawing. And that's when all the thinking about the films happens, in between the camera and the sheet of paper.
Shall we watch either Easy Reading or Making a Horse?
A different thing. We'll come to Making a Horse. That has to do, but no, let's first talk a little bit about, if we're talking, going to show Making a Horse. One of the things about strolling or walking, and maybe it's easier to demonstrate than just to describe it, is... And it's an exercise, if I'm teaching drawing, very often I'll do it also, trying to work out what is the degree of tension you have while moving or while drawing or while making a performance. And you can very often divide things into very clear different degrees of tension. So, which was an exercise we did in theatre school, which is a very good exercise for people wanting to draw. Because everything that you talk about movement can also be translated into a gesture. And the horse, making a horse, which you look at just now, gives us a different area. So you can, to go through those very briefly, if one said the first level, the most relaxed level, the lowest level of tension, would kind of be not quite strolling. Strolling is different, but it's when there's kind of no energy at all, where every step is a kind of uses all the energy. And with that, there's both a voice and a kind of breath. And that would be the first level of tension. And then one could go up a level in which it's much more relaxed, which would kind of correspond to a stroll, where one's sort of moving in a very relaxed way. There's not much tension. It's a way in which one could talk or ramble on to oneself. No one's really going to be listening, or they might. That would be a second. A third degree of tension, which again is very different to the others, would be where everything's very neutral, where you walk and you stop where you're walking, or you turn and there's no inflection. And when you talk or you breathe, the statement is completely matter of fact. And then you get to a fourth degree of tension, which sometimes happens as the drawing is getting closer, as one is thinking more. And that has to be when there's a kind of an intention, a desire. So you don't simply walk, but you go somewhere because you want to get there, or because there's an energy behind that is pushing a thought to happen. And that's when things start to heat up. That's when ideas start to... You have an idea, and that sets in chain another one. And that's an important part of innocence. So in a lot of theatre, that would be kind of the level at which you would start to operate. So that would be a fourth. There's a fifth one which I can't remember, which is more or less the same, a state of alertness, of being alert to things as they emerge. And then a sixth degree of tension would correspond to a kind of passion, when things are really, which would be like commedia dell'arte, where everything is very emphatic and a statement is made, not just because you're interested in it, but because you have to say it. There's a passion and need to make every statement very clear, and every gesture has the same kind of, and when you're drawing, it has a very strong and clear and gestural mark in it. And that would be number six. That could be number six. One could go from that, and you can easily go then from number six, and you have this complete degree of tension, to number three, where it's completely flat, to one, where you can't do it, to four, where you really want to explain what's going on, back to six. Six, we have to explain, because after six comes seven, and seven is very important because that corresponds now to no theatre in Japan, when you are so tense, you can hardly say a C. Okay. And then back to two, where you're very relaxed. So there's a way of making a performance which simply has to do with degrees of tension, which has nothing to do with psychology, but which enables that to arrive at the end. So it's a belief in kind of these kinds of exercises that can be provocative. And the making of a horse, I mean, it's not about degrees of tension, but it's about playing with something that's not psychological. I mean, in the Anglo-Saxon world, generally speaking, theatre starts with a text, and it starts with a psychological analysis of the characters in a play. And for me, the interesting thing working with all the actors on the nose is to try not to work with that, not try to work out what their motivations are. As one of our singers, the barber, says when he jumps into the basket and scales slides down the basket down to the ground, he said, my motivation, my paycheck. And so it's not about motivation, it's about degrees of tension, kinds of movement that I've tried to work with the actors in the performance to do that, to find that. And it means a lot of all of the kind of performances that happen in these, with the wheels, with the playing the music, don't start from either in a psychological analysis of character, what are the three characters there, what different parts, but with a much more practical other set of determinants. Tension is one metaphor you can use, play with these different degrees of tension, or you could do it another one. You could play with materials or animals. Would be another way of arriving at a kind of performance, at a meaning as well as just a performance.
And what we saw you doing, those 6 degrees, not of separation but of tension, you learned while in Paris.
Oh, we
right?
learned I mean, that for, at the theatre school.
At Le Coq.
Yes, and I'm not good at that. I mean, we used to do an exercise which is it's a very hard exercise. It would be to walk from one end of a room to the other, and during the course of the walk to go from the first degree of tension to the seventh and turn around in the seventh and make your way down. And it's not that one can't do those different degrees of tension. That's easy. Everyone could all be doing it here in the room very easily. But the hard thing is knowing what is the energy you need to start off with and the impulse so that your trajectory of changing tensions takes you just to the end wall and you're not still in level 3 by the time you've hit the wall, nor are you at level 7 halfway across the room where it's impossible you're ever going to reach the end wall. And that, whether it's a performance or it's making a line, what is the energy at the start of the line that's going to take it to where it needs to get to at the end without either being pushed or stopped in mid-stride?
Let's look at taking a line then for a walk.
Okay, we can take a...
It's number 5.
This was a piece of film that was made while I was thinking about the lecture I was giving, I'm Not Me, The Horse Is Not Mine. And in the end, the finished film wasn't used. A section of it was used, but not the complete piece.
Do you want to say something about the title?
Well, the Taking a Line for Orc, of course, refers to Paul Klee, who talks about drawing, says one can talk about drawing as taking a line for a walk. And the question I was asking, are we walking the line, or is the line like a dog walking us?
I'm very interested also in the notion of slowness, the way in which you work in a concerted, and you pace yourself. Not only are you pacing, but you work slowly. And slowness is a virtue for you.
I mean, it's a virtue which I'm not good at sticking to. The animated films are slow to make. That is to say, you'll spend take a year to make a 9-minute film, or the Opera of the Nose took 3 years to make, so in that sense it's slow work. But within that, animation is such a slow process itself that you really have to be drawing fast. So that piece of drawing the line, taking a line for a walk, to do the drawing part of it at the end, is it's maybe 2 days' work, but it's really working very fast. So I'm a believer also very much in getting up to speed, in heating yourself up to have a ready energy for work, for the work to be done. And once that starts, a lot of things happen at extreme speed, happen really, really fast. So it's a mixture. I mean, I think, as you say, sometimes time is very slowed down, and sometimes time is...
You know, there's the Latin saying, festina lente, to take haste slowly.
I think this is the other one. I can't remember the Latin. This is making slow very quickly. Yeah. It's the opposite. You have to work really fast to do something that is slow. Particularly in animation, you understand that the more images you make when you project it, the slower a movement becomes. So if you want a really slow movement, you have to be working at double speed, very fast, very hard, very long. And the longer and faster you work, the gentler and slower the movement becomes.
Let's look, if we could, at the first minute and a half of number 3.
Which is this? Lethargy. Oh, lethargy.
Maybe more. Maybe we'll get the mood for it. Just relax.
This again, just I'll say while it's being found, was the first start of the drawing lessons. And until they're filmed, I've no idea what the different people that come into it are going to be doing. So this was a film trying to write the first of the drawing lesson texts. And not much happens for a while. This is a good time to check messages.
I think we should see the whole thing.
This is a lesson in lethargy. We are watching him write, but you can see there aren't really any ideas happening there. What is he reading? Sherried eggs with Gruyere. In the blazer of a chafing dish, melt 2 tablespoons of butter and add 1/2 cup of heavy cream. When the cream is hot, place the blazer over the dish containing hot water and add 1/2 pound of Gruyere cheese, lightly beaten with 1/2 teaspoon of salt. This is not going to give him any ideas. He can continue reading this. What is he writing? A lesson in lethargy. Another lesson in lethargy. He could add in indolence. Look at the way he's sitting. Look at the way he thinks he's concentrating.
hoping for some idea to come towards him while he's busy writing. He's writing in such a way it's not even possible to read his writing. I mean, what has he written here? The artist thinks slowly. This is a lesson in lethargy. I mean, I can't read these notes. I can't read these notes at all. He hopes that if he keeps writing slowly, slowly some idea will germinate in his brain and come towards the front. But in case it doesn't, he writes very badly so that not even he can read what has written down. I mean, what do any of these things say? What do they say over here? You tell me what that says. I mean, what is it there that you've written? Tell us all. I mean, I can't read any notes. I can't read a word of this. None of this is legible. And what is written this? What does this say here? What is that word? Productive or unproductive procrastination. Now what is to be done with that sentence? Okay, and then? Notes towards lethargy, a movement from energy to desuetude, dissolution. I mean, desuetude. I mean, that which is not in use. That
a series
which is
of unsuccessful takeoffs.
I mean, it's clear he has learned nothing. We have learned nothing about lethargy. Thank you.
Extraordinary and painful.
It is. To watch it really is very...
I mean, speak about slowness.
It is. And I mean, it's listening to it, I just feel so... I must apologize that it's so slow. But this is the first version, the first... It'll get better. You'll learn more about lethargy.
No, but this audience is, I think, able to suffer this.
Well, they're very generous, but...
What were you trying to demonstrate by doing this?
I wasn't trying to demonstrate anything. I was trying to see how much do I have to rehearse. Because when the first person is sitting, I have no idea what the second one's going to be saying. They get filmed separately, obviously. So I'm sitting writing, trying to think...
I have no idea how you do this.
Well, film it once writing, and then the second time around, there's no one sitting. So when I'm looking at the table thinking, was he looking up then? What is he doing? Trying to take the notes that I'd just written, trying to read them, which I actually couldn't read. Seeing what text I actually had on the piece of paper that was being read. So in one sense, it's trying to be really conscientious about what is the process of finding ideas. I mean, there's an interest in not only stupid games, but in also finding where do ideas come from, how are they generated.
And where do they come from?
Well, I don't know. That's trying to see. Between reading a lesson on Gruyere cheese and heating it in a chafing dish, what will come up to the idea of desuetude, like suet pudding, but desuetude, that which is not in use, that which has fallen out of use. There's a hint. All I know is that there's a hint that there may be something interesting to pursue. I suspect to pursue it properly will be an enormous amount of work because all the stages. If you want, you film the first stage and then you film the second and you put them together and you realize, no, there's something with the first version. So you have to refilm the first version, then refilm the second and hope that they come together.
And also the importance here of hints.
Well, of hints, I mean, so I'm not sure whether it's going to be best always to rely on improvisation or whether one can gradually, very carefully construct a proper conversation between two or three people.
Because when I saw this a few times, it made me think of the notion of inspiration. Where do ideas come from? How do you happen on things? And I don't know if you know this line of Leonard Cohen, who said that if he knew where inspiration came from, he would go there more often.
It is. I mean, I think that what one can do, and it's difficult, all I can do is I can find strategies to enable ideas to happen. And I know the one way they don't happen is by trying to write down good ideas. They can happen through this kind of improvisation. They can happen through striding around the room.
Pacing.
They can come from fortunate pieces of mistranslation or misunderstanding, more often than from pieces of good, clear reasoning or understanding. They can come from devouring an image, a phrase, a book, a song that one has heard.
And these are eureka moments for you?
They're not eureka moments, but they sit at the back as possible energy and possible material. So the public sphere and the public sphere. It may just be a nice wordplay, but it may... I mean, the whole film Felix in Exile was provoked by the fact that Felix and exile are almost anagrams, which is a stupid basis to start a year's work, but it was enough to provoke, to say he's going to be in exile, we'll put him in a room on his own. If he's on his own, what's his contact with the outside world? A mirror. He finds the landscapes in the drawings, he finds the people in the mirror, and suddenly you've got a whole film that is happening, but which starts, I'm a great believer in you know, the impure and not brilliant beginnings.
And serendipity, things that happen by chance.
It's not chance. It's not about chance. And it's not about program. It's something that's between chance and program. It's good fortune, fortuna, I would describe it as, which is not the same. It's not aleatoric. It's
and
not
how does your body react when you find a good idea? I mean, which stage?
It's almost in every stage it reacts as thinking, God, what an idiot. Not what a good idea, but what not a fool for having realized this earlier. In retrospect, it's completely self-evident and obvious, and I was a fool not to have understood that. So it's always about a curse for being stupid rather than a gold star for being clever.
When did your interest in clapping start?
In clapping?
Yeah.
What clapping is it?
You've been interested in clapping, have you not?
No, I'm interested in it in the nose because of the stories of Stalin and the applause.
Right.
There's a recording of one of his speeches, one of the great speeches, one of his famously long speeches, which is, I think, on five LPs. But the first LP side consists exclusively of applause before he arrives on stage. And there was the great terror, of course, of who stopped clapping first, whose enthusiasm was not as great. And so when the delegates came to these party congresses, which he would speak, there would be buckets of salt water next to them for dipping your hands into when they'd been completely inflamed from applauding and applauding and applauding. So that was the image that intrigued me, these buckets of salt water and pickling your hands and tanning your hands to be able, turning them into leather to have the sufficient level of enthusiasm needed.
When I read that, I thought you shared a passion I have in clapping.
Which is?
Well, my father in 1933 was a claquette in the opera house in Vienna. Did you know that existed?
I've heard of them. I didn't know.
Well, no, he was a claquette, and he would get a modicum amount of groschen to clap. So he taught me, and you can clap really loud. And I thought we shared this passion.
No, you see.
No.
No, listen to the difference. No.
No, I should look. You have to sort of like that.
Yes.
And then you go.
No, you see.
You're getting better.
No.
No, you. No, it's good. So we'll work on it. We'll work on it. In closing, you've mentioned books here and there. Maybe you'd like to say something about this
book sequence we're about to see?
Well, book, I mean, I say different things about books. Books are, apart from the pleasure which all have of being surrounded by books, they've in recent years become one of the main areas on which I do drawing. So there are large numbers of books, none of them particularly rare or valuable. I'm not interested in...
You're not a collector.
I'm not a collector. No, there are a couple of books which I bought thinking I would tear them up, and they've been much too beautiful. And some of them have been saved by the fact that the paper they were printed on is really bad for drawing. So I haven't torn them up. But none of them are great rarities which are suddenly going to disappear from the libraries of the world because I've torn up that edition.
But we'll keep that in mind when you come into this.
I know. There is something. There is a... I once had in my hand a second folio of Shakespeare's second folio.
And what did it tempt you?
And I did think, God, this would be gorgeous paper to draw on. But I didn't put it under my arm. My arm was not big enough for that. But there are a lot of books that do get kind of, there are shelves and shelves in my house of books bought from secondhand bookshops waiting to be torn up and drawn on or tossed about. So in the last little, the fragment we show here, I think, which was also, it was about looking at the grammar of running a camera backwards. Or in good catching, it was practicing, is it easier to just catch well? And it's called Building a Library.
What is the cannon one hears?
The cannon, I mean, that was a machine which has a big spring-loaded thing for shooting the books up to me as they were the court. And the skill was, as you can imagine, it's just below frame. You can see it being loaded with all these books. And that's the pleasure of the book, is this imagined cannon somewhere out of sight. Of course, all that is, it's the sound of the books landing on the floor. So the film is running backwards, but the sound is running forwards. And that sound in this case, because of the logic of the books running, makes you imagine this whole imagined world of someone loading a book into a spring-loaded cannon, firing them off into the world. And that's like the cat flapping its wings, or the public sphere in the public sphere. It's that which we construct from the fragments we are given, our wish to complete the world.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.